Welcome everybody, welcome to another edition of What's My Fruit? I'll try not to go too overboard on the fruit. Really, the main gist of it is Nagarjuna and the Perfection of Wisdom. So this is the fourth week of five in the mini-series Nagarjuna and the Perfection of Wisdom. Which is a part of the longer, year-long series on Heroes of the Dharma, of which Nagarjuna is one. And last week we looked at the Heart Sutra in with myself and Bodhipushpa. Bodhipushpa had a presentation. And I'm going to talk a bit about, and this evening is a bit about, one aspect of the Heart Sutra. Well, really the perfection of wisdom in general, which is shunyata. So that's really what I'm going to be talking about. And it's a very important point, aspect of the perfection of wisdom. It's often translated as emptiness or voidness. The trouble, of course, with translations are that we've already got assumptions as to what emptiness means or voidness means. And so we don't get the precise meaning, which is why often it's not translated. We just refer to it as shunyata. But if we have to translate it, then that's often what it's translated as. But what does it actually mean? What are we actually getting at? Well, the two principal features of shunyata could be said to be impermanence and insubstantiality. So that's all phenomena are impermanent and insubstantial. Now, impermanence is probably easier for us to appreciate intellectually than it was for people at the time of the Buddha, because back in those days, the mountains, the sun, the stars, the moon, the forests seem to be pretty much permanent features. You know, they were around when their fathers were there and their grandfathers and their grandmothers. So they didn't see much change in that way. But of course, we know differently now. We know that mountains, ranges rise and fall. We know that continents move about very slowly. I read on the BBC website today that the moon is moving away from the Earth at 4 centimetres a year, for example. So, and the sun eventually will use up its fuel and expand enormously and destroy the Earth. So that's something to look forward to. But we know so intellectually about impermanence. Of course, realisation of it is another matter, but we know intellectually. The insubstantial nature of phenomena is perhaps a little bit more tricky. And this is where my friend the orange is coming into it. If things were substantial, then that kind of means that they have some intrinsic nature, some substantial nature to them. It's almost like they're like a stick of rock with Blackpool all written all the way through it. There's something orangey about this orange. But again, we kind of, if we analyse this orange, intellectually at least, we know that it's made up of molecules, and we could take one of these molecules away from the orange, and there's nothing particularly orangey about that molecule. That molecule could exist in a grapefruit, or a tangerine, or indeed something else completely. So there's nothing intrinsically orange about that molecule. Similarly, if we go deeper, the atoms that make up an orange, a carbon atom in here, for example, no difference in essence to a carbon atom that makes up me or you or is floating around in the air. So again, no orangeness in that. Aha, you might say, but what about DNA? Surely that is intrinsically orange, isn't it? That's what tells it it's an orange. Well, in this case, the DNA of an orange is an orange tree, so it doesn't actually make it an orange. And in any case, I looked up, just out of interest, how much DNA weighs. And it's not very much. The DNA of a human being weighs 4 millionth of a millionth of a gram. So that's not a great deal at all. So presumably an orange is even less than that. So if we were to extract the DNA from this orange, it would be so negligible. It wouldn't make any difference. It would still be an orange, wouldn't it? So a DNA is clearly not what makes an orange. Also, if it had orange nature, then if I were to peel the orange, and I had the orange peel here and the flesh of the orange there, the orange peel, would that have orange peel nature, or would it still have orange nature? So it kind of, once you think of things in terms of an intrinsic nature and you start to analyse it, it kind of falls down a bit. But another way to look at it, and this is something that I found quite helpful, is looking at the Christian world. They have, as you might be aware, you might even have done this at some time, they have communion, a ritual of communion, where the priest takes some bread and some wine and turns it into the body of Christ and the blood of Christ. What he actually does is it's transubstantiation. Transubstantiation, which means changing the substance. So empirically, it's still bread and it's still wine. It still smells like bread, it still tastes like bread, it still weighs the same as bread, still got the same molecules as bread. But the substance of it has changed to the body of Christ. Now that is, you know, the Catholic belief. That's what actually takes place, according to Catholic belief, in the communion service. From a Buddhist point of view, though, that would be impossible because there is no substance to be changed to the body of Christ. It just is the empirical bits and bobs that make it up. Similar, I suppose, in the way that many belief systems have the idea of a soul, which again is this kind of intrinsic essence of a human being. And of course, in Buddhism, we don't have that ideal of a soul because we don't accept that intrinsic, essential nature of things. Instead, what we tend to have with this idea of insubstantiality is that we have a network of ever-changing, interconnected processes. So there's nothing static or fixed at all at all times. So even things that are changing very slowly, like this building, for example, clearly over hundreds of years or even decades, it would crumble if it wasn't maintained. So even things that seem pretty static and fixed are changing over time, like our mountains and so on. Which brings me to my grapes here. So I was thinking how I could illustrate this a bit more. And if I took, let's just take one of these grapes. Let's put those over there on the subs bench. If we just took one of these grapes and I left it here, for a period of time, it eventually would change into a raisin. Because apparently that's how you get raisins. So now, I don't know, maybe if we came back next week, maybe it would change into a raisin. I suspect it would probably take longer than that, but let's just say if we came back next week, it would be a raisin. So today it's a grape, next week it's a raisin. When did it become a raisin then? If we, you and I came back here every day and checked up on our grape and thought, when did it become a raisin? You might think it became a raisin on Thursday. I might think it became a raisin on Saturday. You know, it's fairly arbitrary. And if you said Thursday, I could say, well, what time on Thursday? 8 o'clock in the morning? 1 o'clock? 1:30? It's fairly arbitrary. And that's the nature of things. Because really, it's more accurate to think of this grape as a process. It's a grape in the process of turning into a raisin, if I leave it here. But it just illustrates the fact that a grape is just a label. And a raisin is just a label, and they're fairly arbitrary. What we've really got here is a process, something in the process of change. Ooh! And not only that, of course, it's dependent on conditions. So if I leave the grape here, it turns into a raisin if nobody comes along and eats it. On the other hand, if I took this grape and its friends here and squashed them up into made some juice and then left it in the right conditions, it would ferment and turn into wine, something completely different. So what things arise depends upon their conditions. which of course is entirely in accord with the Buddha's teaching of pratijñāsamuppāda, or conditioned co-production, the idea that things arise depending upon their conditions. Now this is great in a way because it gives us opportunities, it gives us possibilities. It means that we can create the conditions for things to arise. Without that, change would not be possible at all. But fortunately it is. If we look a bit more, let's leave the fruitless to one side for the moment and come back to ourselves and our emotional state. Sometimes you might wake up in the morning and feel pretty good about things. Other days you might wake up in the morning and feel a bit fed up, a bit depressed. And sometimes there might be a reason for that, an apparent reason for that, but sometimes it just seems to be the way things are. Of course, the world, samsara, you know, there's ups and downs, things happen, but it is just samsara, the way it is. So it seems to be that, you know, our perspective of the world, how we feel about the things, is often conditioned by our responses and the way that we react. And if we look at these, our responses, our reactions, our perceptions, we can examine them and see that they too are empty of any intrinsic nature. They're impermanent and they're insubstantial. We'll have some practice with this a bit later on. So we have this samsara, the world out there, and we have our responses to it. How might we relate to our responses? What might be some advice? Well, I have some advice here from the Buddha. He's talking to Subhuti, and this is from the Diamond Sutra, which is another of the Perfection of Wisdom texts. And so the Buddha said, "So I say to you, this is how to contemplate our conditioned existence in the fleeting world. Like a tiny drop of dew, or a bubble floating in a stream, like a flash of lightning in a summer cloud, or a flickering lamp, an illusion, a phantom, or a dream. So is all conditioned existence to be seen." So it's this idea of seeing, trying to get to understand the real nature of existence and the real nature of phenomena, and that real nature being emptiness. It takes us back as well to the middle way, which Singanada was talking about 2 weeks ago. Looking at things such that realizing that there is no permanence, that there is no substantial nature to things, and yet on the other hand, they do exist in some way, shape or form. So we have this middle way, this approach of the middle way between these two extremes of taking things to be fixed and permanent on the one hand, or taking things to be non-existent, this nihilistic approach on the other hand. So we're going for this middle way of emptiness. So more to the point then, what does this mean about ourselves? If there is no orange nature, then there's no Taranita nature either. So what does that mean for me then? If there's no Taranita nature, then what am I? And this is this kind of thing, you know, what am I, is something that's very well worth reflecting upon. And we'll get a chance to do that a bit later as well. I talked last week about the when we were talking about the Heart Sutra, I brought in the idea of the five skandhas, which are mentioned in the Heart Sutra. So we have form, feeling or sensation, thought or perception, choice or volition, and discriminative consciousness. So these five divisions, the way that our entire existence, our entire universe, can be split up into these five things. And we can look at these five things in our own experience again and just become aware of them, be with those experiences and see what their true nature is. It's likely, assuming that we're not enlightened beings, that we might as well feel some unskillful emotions sometimes, perhaps ill will, jealousy, envy, pride, whatever, what have you. And we may feel some unpleasant emotions sometimes. And again, it's very useful to be with the experience of these emotions, rather than just trying to push them away. And rather than seeing them as in some way permanent as well, is accepting their true nature and realizing their true nature of actually being impermanent and insubstantial. In the Heart Sutra again, it talks about our sense organs, where it talks about no eye, no ear, no nose, and so on and so forth. And what's trying to be got at here is this approach of regarding our sensations that arise without any bias, without any predilection, just trying to see things really as they are. Again, this brings to mind Sigananda's story of Bahia. And how he approached the Buddha, and he said, how should I practice? How should a wise person practice? And he was told by the Buddha, in the seen, there should be only the seen. In the heard, there should be only the heard. And so on. Which can seem a bit of a paradoxical or a bit of an enigmatic teaching, perhaps. So I've got a reading here that talks about the meaning of this. It's from Ajahn Brahm. So what the Buddha means when he was talking to Bahia in this way was, what it means is to see without any distortion of the data, without adding or subtracting from it. As modern psychology knows, what comes to our attention as the seen has already been sifted and distorted by our desires and aversions. The process of distortion occurs prior to the event of cognition. It is impossible to see the process as it occurs. It is subconscious. We can only infer its occurrence. We discover that our preferences have embellished the data to present to our mind what we wanted to see, while hostility has denied any access to the mind for those features that we didn't want to see. What we see is rarely merely the seen. That which we see with bare attention is seldom the truth. It is not the way things are. It is only the way things seem. So it's a challenge to be able to see things exactly the way they are, because it's the nature of our mind to imprint upon them our own preferences and our own aversions. In the same way that we find it difficult, perhaps, to give credit to people we don't like. So, why does this matter then, really? Why does it matter to see, you know, see only the seen, hear only the heard? Why does that really matter? Well, as I think I've quoted before, Sangharakshita, the founder of our movement, has said, the only way you can get to reality is by destroying all your ideas about reality. So we really need to try and sort of break through our perceptions, the way that we tend to think things are. In the Heart Sutra, it talks about the bonds that cause us suffering. In the introduction, for example, it mentions that the Bodhisattva of compassion, Avalokiteshvara, has sundered the bonds that caused him suffering. So these bonds being the delusion, the misunderstanding of the nature of things, and in particular, the fact that we tend to think of things as being impermanent, insubstantial, and ultimately unsatisfactory. Even though we can logically deduce that things are impermanent, the true realization, the true seeping through to our entire nature is more of a challenge, takes a bit more doing. But that's what we need to do if we really need to realise the true nature of existence and therefore sunder the bonds that cause us suffering. An example of this could be fear, which I'm sure all of us encounter from time to time. We can see the fear as we can experience the fear and realize it as being ultimately empty, insubstantial and impermanent. Nothing to get fixed to get hold of. Once we can realise that, truly realise that, then we can understand that there really is nothing to fear in the first place. Perhaps another example as well is the way that we tend to grasp things in order to try and get ourselves some sort of satisfaction, some sort of happiness. A friend of mine, it was a few years ago now, it was on his 40th birthday, but he thought, well, I've been working for 25 years, and I deserve a little present for myself. Well, perhaps he did. And he decided to buy himself a nice new car, quite a nice, sporty new car. And it was quite expensive, but he was very happy with it initially. But then a few problems arose. So that, for example, he parked in a supermarket car park and it got scratched. And so then he was very upset by that. His insurance went up, which was already quite expensive anyway because it was a bit of a sporty car. And then he worried about leaving it. So rather than being a source of joy, it became a source of anxiety because he was always worried about where he would leave it and if it would get damaged. And also, he ended up using my car as well. His car, going all the way to Birmingham, it's a bit uncomfortable. So he ended up going in my car. So so it's ironic, in a way, that the things we grasp for can often be the source of our suffering. It's a kind of supreme irony. It's almost a delicious irony. But it's those things that we grasp for, that we think that will make us happy, that is actually the source of our suffering. It's not understandable why it's quite a difficult thing to do, I suppose, because it's quite a trap, really. Not that it's necessarily a bad thing to buy a new car or what have you, but it's just, I think, interesting and, well, it's useful to be clear about the reasons that you're doing it. If it's because it would be useful to have a new car, then it's probably a good thing to do. But if you're just doing it just to make you happy, then possibly not quite so much. But it's not all about new cars, is it? It's even things like wisdom or attainment or spiritual ignorance. These things too are empty. And it's this true realization of the nature of emptiness from which we can get liberation. I'd like to bring in another example here. One of my favourite things is the... it's not really my favourite things, the eight world events, I was going to say. It's not that I like them. It's that I find them useful to talk about. So you may have come across this before, the eight worldly winds. So we have praise, and blame, gain, and loss, fame and shame, happiness and despair. Now, these are translations, so you might hear them, you might see different terms used from time to time, but you get the idea. So you've got four pairs of things that are more or less the opposite of one another. And what I like about the four worldly winds is that it kind of describes how they, the effect they have on us quite well, I think. It's like, you're blown around by the worldly winds. How you can go along quite happily and then something crops up and you're kind of blown off course. So I think it's a good thing. But even the positive aspects, which you might think, well, let's just get rid of the bad ones and then we'll just have the nice ones. But of course, the world's not like that. And in any case, the positive ones tend to have the seed of their negative counterpart in them. So a prime example might be if you've got a lot of praise about something, you might start to get a bit puffed up. You might think, hey, I'm actually pretty good at this. You might get a bit of...
hubris.
Yes, that's the word. Yeah, hubris. Yeah, yeah. And
sort of inflated. Yeah,
yeah. But of course, the more inflated that you get, the more liable you are to be punctured if you get pricked by somebody criticising you. And the more deflated that you would then become. So, but the idea being our approach here can be to just see them for what they are, really. Not that they're bad things necessarily in themselves, but just see them as they are, impermanent and insubstantial. And ultimately not satisfying as well. They are empty. So again, when we can realise this, we can kind of let go of that and just let the worldly winds blow about, but we will serenely just be there, content regardless. Another problem with all of this is, and I'm going to bring the fruit back in now, another problem with all of this could be that you could replace one concept with another. You could start to think, well, yes, orange, yes, I know, but the orange is just the label. Really what we have here is emptiness. What you can end up doing is maybe sort of solidifying in some way that idea of shunyata. You can sort of start thinking, yes, I think I pretty much understand that now, I've got a handle of that. And really what you can end up doing is replacing one concept, the orange, with another, shunyata. The Perfection of Wisdom teachings foresaw that possibility and so tried to preempt it and give us teachings to help get over that. So last week, Bodhipushpa mentioned the Pranyaparamita mantra, which we chanted just a few minutes ago, Gata Gata Paragata Parasamkati Bodhiswaha. And she also gave us a translation, which was something along the lines of gone, gone, gone beyond, gone altogether beyond. Oh, what an awakening, all hail. So there are four gones there, and they refer to the four different levels of emptiness, shunyata. So the first gone refers to the fact that we can see, realise, I should say, the emptiness of ordinary everyday things, such as our friend the orange, and our own emotions, and praise and blame, and so on and so forth. So we can see the emptiness in those things. The second gone refers to realization of the emptiness of enlightenment, of nirvana itself. Then the third gone beyond, refers to a realization of the emptiness of the difference between those two things. So really the distinction between enlightenment and non-enlightenment, that too is empty. And then the final gone altogether beyond, is a realization of the emptiness of emptiness itself. Shunyata, shunyata, as is referred to. So as I've mentioned in previous talks, it's a good idea to try and have a loose hold on the concepts of Buddhism and an awareness that we have a provisional understanding all the way up to enlightenment, and so try to keep an open mind, as it were. So where does that leave us? Well, it leaves us, as the Heart Sutra kind of says, really holding to nothing whatever. Which, when we did that exercise last week and we were talking about our favourite lines, I realised that was my favourite line in the Heart Sutra. Holding to nothing whatever. So not only do we have no bonds holding us back, we're not holding on to anything ourselves either. Which could be quite scary, really, but also quite exhilarating and open to possibilities. So holding to nothing whatever. The Dalai Lama's got something to say about this, so I'll read that out now. He says, even emptiness itself is not absolute, nor does it exist independently. We cannot conceive of emptiness as independent of a basis of phenomena, because when we examine the nature of reality, we find that it is empty of inherent existence. Then, if we were to take that emptiness itself as an object and look for its essence, again, we will find that it is empty of inherent existence. Therefore, the Buddha taught the emptiness of emptiness. Um, A lot of this stuff can seem a bit, perhaps, tricky, paradoxical, and that is kind of the nature of the perfection of wisdom. And that's kind of okay in a way. Don't worry if it's intellectually you find it difficult to kind of get your head around, as they say. It's, you know, useful to study these things. It's even more useful, I think, to reflect upon them and just be with them and compare it to your experience and see whether it does actually correspond with your experience. You know, is your experience really impermanent? Are your emotions really impermanent or insubstantial? So it's very good to reflect on all that stuff. But really, it's just nice to be around it, I think, and let it have an effect. Because it is important that it isn't just an intellectual effect, but has an effect on one's whole being, one's whole body, one's emotional life as well as intellectual life. Buddhism is sometimes seen, I think, as avoiding the world. In fact, my old friend Richard Dawkins, who he's not really my friend, but I read from his stuff last week, and a big fan of his evolutionary work. But he was looking at religions once, and I got the impression that he kind of dismissed Buddhism as being mostly harmless, but I think he kind of misunderstood. He was talking to people who were meditating, and he kind of got the impression that it was really opting out of the world. And that's not really how I see things. I think, yes, you meditate and you might go on retreats and so on, and you might have moments of stillness and quiet and so on, but I think that's really to get a better understanding of the way things really are and a better understanding of oneself. And in doing so, that enables you to return to the world and interact with the world in a much more positive, helpful, healthy way. So when you're not using up energy dealing with these sorts of things, energy and time, then you've got that energy and time to devote to perhaps more helpful things, more useful things. So I don't think it is true that Buddhism is really about opting out of the world. I think quite the opposite. And I've got a reading which says something about this. And this is talking about an individual who I think really does have a deep realisation of the way things actually are. And rather than sitting somewhere in a cave, I'll tell you what he does. Bare-chested and barefooted, he enters the market, face streaked with dust and head covered with ashes. But a mighty laugh spreads from cheek to cheek. Without troubling himself to work miracles, suddenly dead trees breaking to bloom. In friendly fashion, the fellow comes from a foreign race, with features like a horse or a donkey. But on shaking his iron staff, all of a sudden, all gates and doors spring wide open for him. With a great laugh spread over his face, he talks Mongolian, he speaks Chinese. He enters the market, swirling his staff, he returns home. He frequents wine shops and fish stalls to make the drunkards open their eyes and awaken to themselves. Thank you very much.